Call the Judiciary Committee to order today. It's 1:32. We got Senator Olson present and Senator Dyson present and Chair Coghill. Others are doing other things, I think, in other parts of the state. So we'll try to limp along and do the state's business without them. So today we have three things that I'd like to do. Senate Bill 110, which is Senator Dyson's bill, we have an amendment that will come up. We'll navigate through that, and my intention is to bring that up to a vote today. Then we'll go to Senator Egan, who has Senate Bill 66 up. Another probably important issue dealing with some of the substance abuse issues that we have in Alaska. And then lastly, I wanted to give ample opportunity for the court system, judicial counsel, to come and put perspective on the constitutional amendment and ask time for questions. And with some apology for the committee not having all members present, but I will tell you this, I am not interested in passing out a constitutional amendment without all members present and engaged in discussion. So just for what it's worth, for those who think that I will try to pass it out with just three members on the committee. We do have some things coming up Monday, but my intention is to bring the Joint Resolution 21 up on Monday again. So for those of you listening in, I probably will not close public testimony on that. We'll just continue on. I think that deserves a lot of debate. So at this point, Senator Dyson, you have Senate Bill 110. So if the members will look in their packet under Senate Bill 110, Senator Dyson, you have the floor.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We had some discussion in our last meeting about an amendment that was forwarded to us by the Office of Victims Rights and the Advocate, and we have distributed to you an amendment that is A.1, and I move that we accept Amendment A.1.
And I'll object, and if I could have Mr. Kopp come and explain a little bit of the amendment, if you don't mind, Senator Dyson,
fine,
how it fits in and what the questions that we're answering are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Fred Dyson. The amendment language referred to by the bill sponsor was brought to us via the court system in conjunction working with the Office of Victims' Rights. Department of Law reviewed it as well. It's the bill sponsor's understanding that all parties are agreeable to it. And briefly, Mr. Chairman, the amendment clarifies in statute that the office has a right to file a request to advocate for the return of the crime victim's property, and it does not grant them any broader role than that. And that's it.
And my guess, yes, Mr. Senator Dyson.
Yeah. And it answers the question that had come up, and it had come up from some victims who hadn't been able to get their property back. What if the agency doesn't petition to get the property released? It gives another avenue for the victim's advocate to go before the court to petition for the return of the property.
But it keeps it narrow to the
yes.
property
yes,
Mr. question.
Chairman.
And rather than getting involved in maybe an underlying case. And I think
yes.
I can see that protection
yes.
in there as well.
And I understand, Mr. Chairman, that Taylor Winston from the Office of Victims' Rights is online if any questions come up.
Is there any questions for Taylor Winston? It was tough the last time Taylor had a rough connection, but I think she gave her testimony very thoroughly, so I have no question. And with that, I'll remove my objection to this amendment. Any other objection? Seeing none, then we'll adopt amendment number 1, which is A.1. And so, on the bill, Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we move from committee Senate Bill 110 as amended with individual recommendations on to the next committee referral.
Is there a fiscal note on this? With the attached fiscal note?
Yes, sir. With the attached fiscal note.
Is there any objection to moving Senate Bill number 110 as amended from committee with the attached fiscal note? No objection. Senate Bill 110 then moves from committee. Thank you, Senator Dyson, for your work, and thank you, Mr. Kopp, for helping out. And thanks for the victim's advocate testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next thing we have on today's schedule, and my intention is to kind of bring it up for introduction and questions and then hold it over. We also have one other bill similar, and I'm going to ask him some of those questions. So, Senator Egan, why don't you come on forward and introduce Senate Bill 66 and any staff member that you want to have help you with that discussion.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Dennis Egan, representing District P, and with me, my chief of staff, Alita Buss. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 66 makes it easier for law enforcement to crack down on drug dealers by making illegal any substance represented as a controlled substance. As an example, drug dealers often rip off customers by selling them sheetrock dust, or and they pass it off as meth or oregano as marijuana. When someone offers phony drugs to a law enforcement officer during a sting operation, the officer cannot make a charge because the substance doesn't contain a specific ingredient on the list of imitation controlled substances in current statute. The current definition of imitation controlled substances in AS 1173099 parent 3 lists chemicals a substance must contain in order to be illegal. Senate Bill 66 changes the definition of an imitation controlled substance to more generally make illegal any substance made to look like an already illegal drug. By omitting specific chemicals from the definition, the change makes illegal a substance that is not a controlled substance and that by dosage unit appearance, including color, shape, size, and markings, and by representations, would lead a reasonable person to believe that the substance is a controlled substance. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 66 will change our imitation controlled substance law to enable law enforcement officers to more effectively charge drug dealers in the state of Alaska.
And thank you for bringing the issue forward. So I notice we took a lot of.
We have a officer of the Juneau Police Department.
Oh, good, good. There are
want to testify.
Good. There are specific questions I'm going to be asking. So the first, I'll ask you first, and maybe your staff can help you out, or I can go to the Juneau Police. The representation. We've took all the containing words out, right? All the different drugs out, and just said that it has to be a representation. So in doing that, is there anything that you know of that falls off the table as far as some of the more harmful drugs? Because we did probably argue those particular drugs in, right?
Well, the problem, Mr. Chair, is that we were too specific, and what happens is they change the formulas on some of these drugs, and especially with fake drugs. I mean, you can grind up acetaminophen, and or you can grind up something else, or sheetrock dust. Mm-hmm. And if it's not on that list, then the police officers can't charge.
So, Senator Dyson, do you have a question? Oh, okay.
Alita Buss, for the record.
Alita,
Mr. Chair, I believe things like ephedrine are still covered on a list of certain chemicals.
But and that was what I was looking at. It looks to me like the O2O in this section is repealed, so you've taken all of them off. So it wasn't just the ones that are listed in section sub 3, but the whole list of the lidocaine, procaine, you know, all the canes and ophens, or whatever, you know. And so I was just wondering if, and it looks to me like, and you probably know better than I do, so I'm asking a question I very seldom do. I don't have an inkling of the answer. But this is a Class C felony, right?
Mr. Chair, we do have a committee substitute.
Uh-huh.
I know there were some concerns that it may be too stiff, and we have a committee substitute that we can offer, or you can take up that lowers that.
All right. Well, we'll take a look at that. Thank you. I just wanted to let you know that it seemed pretty stark to me, but on the representation, but the drugs that you outlined, if you went to the specifics, really are clear.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, but the problem is that there are a lot more clever than we are, and when we get specific, we get in trouble.
That's true, and I appreciate the attempt of fixing this, so I'll work with you on it. And so those are just the top questions I had. At this point, we go ahead and let the police department give testimony, and I wanted to frame at least part of that discussion for them to give testimony. Thank you very much. So the Juneau Police Department detective, why don't you come on up and put yourself on the record, and thank you for coming to the committee and helping us think our way through this. Greatly appreciate it. Put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Lee Phelps, L-E-E-P-H-E-L-P-S. I work for the Juneau Police Department. I've been in the Drug Enforcement Unit for about 2.5 years now. The reason that I'm here to testify is that in the past I have, in the past 2.5 years, have been a part of well over 100 controlled buys, and although this law is helpful, it's rarely used, but in those 100 buys, only 3 times have I been sold anything that was not a controlled substance. And in some of the cases, it was solvent methamphetamine or cooked down Tootsie Rolls or who knows what as heroin. And so if that's the case, we sent it to the crime lab. They say it's not a controlled substance. And then because it's not, you know, ephedrine, pseudoephedrine, or any of these chemicals, then there's no crime. And as I said, it would hardly be used, the imitation controlled substance laws, but if we change it to be any substance that they purport to be a controlled substance, we buy a pinch of salt for $120, mm-hmm. then it would fit under the imitation controlled substance law.
So at that point, intent becomes something that you have to show, but that would be true whether it was a actual controlled substance or a representation of one, true?
Yes, and that is also still in the definition where the statements that they make, the way that they package it, everything about it, that they were trying to sell it off as a real controlled substance, even though it's not. And in the past, you know, we've tied our hands with this list, and they just use something that's not on the list and kind of get away with one.
Senator Dyson has a question.
Yeah, thanks for helping us. I appreciate the work you've probably done. I'm trying to picture you looking like a drug buyer and fooling somebody.
First time I've worn a suit in a while.
Yeah, okay, well, you look good. I suspect you don't make your buys wearing that suit.
No.
All right. Don't misunderstand the next question. The guy's actually guilty of fraud, too, you know, misrepresentation. What level of fraud gets to be across the threshold that it's illegal or that prosecutors would pay attention to in prosecuting them?
In the instances where this has happened, we're unable to charge the imitation controlled substance law. We have charged a theft, but it's a misdemeanor for $120 or.
Yeah. What class misdemeanor?
I believe that would be a B misdemeanor for. I could check really quick.
So a theft must include. Getting something of worth under false pretenses.
Correct. And then it, I think it's $50 or more, then it's an A felony.
It's always nice to have one of those handy books.
Yeah.
So we'll give you a second to look it up.
It would be a Class A if it would be over $50.
Interesting. If I may continue, Mr. Chairman, has a defense ever brought up the concept of mens rea, you know, criminal intent?
I've never been to an actual trial where this has been brought up. Usually things are pled out beforehand. Yeah. So I don't know about that. Sorry.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
I don't have any other questions. I think the question on the actual level of crime, but what I'm looking at here is it looks like we're repealing 020, which actually has the section with Class C felony. So I'm going to have to do a little bit of studying to make sure I understand it. That's actually the case, because 99, I have to go back and find out. 73099, I don't see the level in there. So for you guys, I know there's a lot of work goes into stuff like this. And certainly the danger is just as high, especially if something is intravenous and it's not. I mean, the control substance is bad enough, but it could be deadly if it wasn't. So, yeah, I think it would be very interesting. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, just an interesting question for me. I live near Anchorage. Been a huge increase in black tar heroin sale and so on, but what's heroin, good coke, and like oxycodone selling for here?
Right now, the street level price for heroin is $100 for 1 point of a gram, so a tenth of a gram is $100. Obviously, the more you buy in bulk, the
sure.
cheaper it would get, but
volume discount.
Yes, and then for methamphetamine, consistently buying a 0.3 grams for $120, or for cocaine, as a gram is about $100, $120.
Oxy?
And oxy, it depends on the strength of the pill, so it kind of varies with the strength.
Used to be in Anchorage, it was 85. You know, bucks, but I understood that the old capsule form was going quite a bit more of it, and folks were learned how to smoke it and shoot it. Is that true here?
Yes. Back in, I think, is it 2008 when it was really rampant, those pills, the Oxy 80, the 80 milligram pills, were started out at $100 and got up to $240 a piece and even higher, but those aren't produced. We're not seeing them. Here, and so there's the 30s and the 20s, but those are depending on the milligram for the price. So.
And it's also Senator Dyson. We have Lieutenant Rodden Dial on from the Department of Public Safety, and I do have a question for Tracy Wallenberg, who's a public defender. So stay tuned, Tracy. Any other questions for the detective? Detective Lee, thank you very much for coming before us. That is helpful. A lot more pricing than I ever thought that I'd hear in committee, but for your work, I am grateful. Tracy, can you hear me all right? This is Senator Coghill.
I can, Mr. Chairman.
I know this is inappropriate because I normally do my homework before I get here, but where are we in the actual charge on it now if we take this and just have it representations and we've repealed 020?
Mr. Chairman, I actually didn't have to concede. I didn't even notice that until you pointed it out, that you were effectively repealing 020, which contains the level of offense.
Uh-huh. All right, so that's something that we'll have to work on, and I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't missing something so that the maker of the bill has a chance to think that through. And one of the things I've learned in my tenure in the legislature is always look at the repealers.
I'm sorry, if I could correct myself quickly. There
sure.
is still 1173010,
okay.
Which provides that, except as provided in 1173050, which is the sort of placebo exception.
Gotcha.
A person may not manufacture, deliver, or possess with intent to deliver an imitation-controlled substance. And that is a Class C felony. So actually, I'm correcting myself now. I think that 1173020, which is the section that's the proposal is to repeal that, deals only with the possession of those individual substances, those individual chemicals with the intent to manufacture an imitation controlled substance. That provision would be repealed. But I'm looking at 010, which would still prohibit manufacturing, delivering, or possessing the actual imitation controlled substance, and that would be a Class C felony.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I actually, now that I'm looking at it some more, and I apologize for my delayed response, I think it's still covered under 010.
Thank you. And so at this point, we're talking about imitation, and so we're taking the intent to manufacture off. Are we then taking representation to a broader into the intent to manufacture, or are we just going to not speak to that from your perspective?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that I completely understand the question. I think, you know, by removing the chemical, the individually listed chemical substance, you're obviously making the definition of imitation controlled substance broader, and perhaps vaguer, because it'll be subject, you know, to sort of appearance and representations of the person, as opposed to being sort of tied to specifically limited chemicals. And so in that respect, I think it's broadening the definition of imitation controlled substance.
Okay. And as
I'm not sure that answered your question, though.
That helps me. That gives me a little more something to chew on. So Senator Dyson had a question as well.
Sure.
Thanks for helping us, Tracy. So putting on your had as a public defender, if you were defending a client who had been accused of misrepresenting sheetrock and selling it in baggies, what would be your concerns to protect the defendant's rights?
Well, one of my concerns is the level of offense that we mentioned before. You know, the scheme is set up to pit that as a Class C felony, which is the same felony level as possession of certain types of actual controlled substances. So, you know, one thing to consider is whether it makes sense to be, you know, punishing that, the manufacture or delivery of, you know, sheetrock, the same as you would be punishing the possession of, you know, some small amount of cocaine, of, you know, marijuana or cocaine, which could be a Class C felony under 1171.040. I guess the other, you know, the other thing that the defense attorney might focus on again is what I mentioned before, which is, you know, what were these representations? Was it reasonable to think that the other person, that the substance was marketed as a controlled substance, and that the dosage unit made it appear so. You know, one of the issues is, you know, the bill's a little broad. It could wind up capturing some things that you're not intending to capture, while not necessarily grabbing a hold of sort of the next thing, if you will. You know, if you're trying to get the next spice, you might not be able to do that because the whole way it's marketed is, you know, this isn't a controlled substance. This isn't something that's protected by the law. And that sort of thing may just have to wait for the law to catch up with it.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I can picture one of the people you're defending, either speaking for themselves or through you, saying, Judge, I never intended to sell them any cocaine. What I intended to do was defraud them of their money, and I wasn't aimed at getting them hooked. I was aimed of getting their money, and so you can get me for fleecing dummies, but you can't get me for drug selling. And I had no intention, no mens rea here of getting somebody stoned. Can you picture yourself in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a mens rea, the question of what mens rea applies to the statute, like you said earlier, I believe. usually as to conduct, there's a knowing mens rea. So with regards to the manufacturer or delivery, there would typically be a knowing mens rea with regards to that. And then the question becomes, what's the mens rea with regards to an imitation-controlled substance? And is it intent, or is it, you know, intending to do the thing you just stated, which is get the person hooked on drugs or convince them that it's drugs, or is it just the intent to gain some sort of financial benefit? That seems to me to go more to motive than it does to the mens rea that would necessarily have to be proved under the statute.
Yeah, thank you.
Just got a note passed to me, and maybe Mr. Dial could chime in on this one, but note said you could actually get a misdemeanor for selling marijuana and a felony for selling oregano under this particular scenario. So I don't know who could answer that, but is it all on intent at that point? And so, it's just a question I have. I don't know if anybody has an answer for, but, we have the Senator Staff wants to come up here, so come on up.
Mr. Chairman, Alita Best, Staff to Senator Egan. Just briefly, that's something that we did look at. It seems like a heavy hand to give a Class C felony for oregano when marijuana is a misdemeanor. And so we've talked to legal, and they've drafted something that would reduce the class of crime.
So you could come back with that, and maybe you could explain to us kind of the breadth of that when we get here. So, okay, good. Good. As you can see, that's what I'm trying to do is ask questions so that we can kind of think this through and turn out a good bill. So thank you. That's a good retort. Any other questions at this point? Mr. Dial, I know I set you up for a question, but I didn't actually ask it. Is there any comments from this point on?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with Department of Public Safety stationed out of Ketchikan. I would just say the department has no concerns with Senate Bill 66. I have been following the conversation, though, and would like to point out that currently, a person can also be charged with delivery of an imitation-controlled substance to a minor, and that is actually a Class B felony listed under 1173.030, and this legislation would not affect that either.
Okay.
And then regarding the theft questions, theft in the third degree is anything more than $50 and less than $500, and that is a Class A misdemeanor. Anything less than 50 would be, of course, a theft in the fourth degree, and that's a B misdemeanor. But our drug investigators routinely come across substances that are portrayed as controlled that are often not listed under statute as qualifying to allow an individual to be charged. Recent examples, we've encountered sweetheart candy where the S has been rubbed off and passed off as Oxycontin, or brown sugar melted down and passed off as heroin. And under these cases, we've not been able to charge the individual. And other than that, I'm available for any questions.
And thank you for your work. Senator Dyson has a question for you, Lieutenant.
Once again, thank you for helping us, Lieutenant Dial. So I assume from what you've said that you've had trouble getting prosecutors to go forward with a case on fraud in those situations?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, that is correct.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
All right. Lieutenant, I sure appreciate the comments, and it looks like we have some homework for the senator. And so what we'll do is we'll set Senate Bill 66 aside. We'll bring it back up. Probably won't be Monday. It'll probably be Wednesday, just to give you an idea, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate the sponsor and others thinking about the appropriateness of the level of it. Class C felony also includes somebody that runs a brothel and could be in business for a long time with a lot of employees. And to make somebody who's selling sheetrock or sugar face the same level of an offense as a felony seems disproportionate.
However, just to speak to the other side, Once you get a young person hooked on heroin, you have a lifetime of problems. So it's not a whole lot different than a brothel in some cases.
If I reply, that's irrelevant to this issue because the person's not selling anything that's controlled. They're largely engaged in fraud.
So they shoot it up and die. But then that's another question, so I understand that. And the point's well taken, Senator. I just had to get his blood pressure up. All right, with that, Senate Bill 66 is set aside. We'll bring it up probably the Wednesday. All right, thank you very much. At this point, I want to take a brief at ease so we can sign the bill that we just passed out. So we'll take a brief at ease. All right, we'll bring the Judiciary Committee back to order. It's 6 minutes after 2. So the next thing we're going to do is we're going to bring up testimony on Senate Joint Resolution number 21. Before we do that, though, I'm going to have Jordan bring up a CS that I would like to adopt, and this is in keeping with the sponsor who wants to have this CS brought before us. And what I'd like to do is do I have a copy of it here, Jordan?
Yep.
I got to find it here. I'm sorry. It's the end version?
Yes.
All right.
You ready for?
Would you just make the motion to accept it as the, and I'll object until we hear, and then I'll we'll move on from there. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we accept CS for Senate Joint Resolution number 21 /N as our working document.
And I'm object only so that we can have it put on the record what the changes in this particular document are, and then my expectation is we'll take it as our working as is the bill at this point. So I'm going to have my judiciary staff explain the changes, and then we'll go from there.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. This is version N in front of you, and as you'll recall, the current version has five attorney members and 10 non-attorneys. What this CS does is it keeps the attorney members at 3, how it currently is in the Constitution, and raises the non-attorney members to 6. The only other changes are in Section 2 of the bill on page 2, which makes the transitional aspects conform with the change in seats.
All right. And I see, instead of having the number of majority members, you actually just say a majority of its members.
Correct. Majority of members participating in a vote.
All right. So that's the changes. And I heard the sponsor agreeing to that earlier. And so what we'll do is we'll start here, and then we'll have the sponsor come speak to it probably on Monday at this point. Okay, I will remove my objection unless there's further objection.
Actually, I had a question for him.
Okay, I'm going to remove my objection. We'll take this before us, and we do have questions for Jordan.
Have you spoken to the sponsor about these changes that are here? Is he in favor of it?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Olson. Yes, we have, and he is good with this.
So the changes essentially are: you're going from 3 public members to 6 public members.
Correct.
And leaving everything else the same. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No more questions.
Okay. Thank you. And I just actually am presenting for the sponsor on this particular issue. So it was something he suggested, and I wanted my staff to bring forward. So it was. So at this point, I would like to have go ahead and get public testimony. Were there questions you wanted to talk about at this point?
No.
Okay. All right. I have Nancy Mead here from the court system, and last time I think we ran our meeting right to the end, and it's time now to hear both from the court system, and we'll hear from the Judicial Council. And for those of you online, don't get too weary because I'm going to get to you as soon as I can. Nancy will have probably more than one opportunity. I'm sorry. Nancy Mead will have a chance. The court system will have a chance to speak to this probably more than once. But I do want them to put on the record their concerns or support.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. And as you know, members of the committee, the court system works closely with you on many bills, but we rarely take a position on proposed legislation. We only oppose a bill or resolution that would directly impact one of our core functions or a core function of the judicial branch. And I am here today to oppose SJR 21 because it is one of those bills. And I'd like you to know that the court doesn't take this step lightly, and this is done only at the direction of the Supreme Court for me to take a position against a bill or resolution. So first, I'd just like to be a little bit clear about the court's role and why I'm testifying. The judicial branch of government is actually made up of three entities: the court system, the largest and the one usually people think of, and two very small ones, the Judicial Council and the Commission on Judicial Conduct. The court system is often used interchangeably with the judicial branch, which is completely understandable and makes sense in almost every context, because the other two entities are small and have defined authority, and they have small budgets and few employees. So the court system is not the council. The council has separate offices, separate employees, separate administrators. I've never even been to their offices, for example. The court system does depend very much on the work that the council does. The council screens judicial applicants for judgeships, and we, the court, needs judicial applicants that are qualified to maintain the public's trust and confidence in all the work that we do. So we, the court system, need the council to do a thorough, fair job with screening the applicants. And we want to have a top-notch group of judges, and that's what their work helps us keep. Nobody wants judges that are not fairly chosen or that are anything short of the top, most ethical, respectable folks in their profession. So it's because of this interdependence that the court is testifying on the resolution that affects the Judicial Council. So SJR 21 has the potential to significantly change the judicial screening and selection process, even though that process has worked effectively for over 50 years. The current council selects the most qualified applicants based on their merit. We have a merit selection process, which is considered the gold standard in judicial selection around the country. If what you want is fair, impartial judges hearing and deciding your disputes. Merit selection means that the judges are screened and chosen based on their legal knowledge, their skills like writing and organizing and creating cogent arguments, their ability to identify flaws and nuances in other people's arguments or reasoning, their judicial temperament, that is their ability to control a courtroom, maintain their civility in emotional situations, and to be polite and firm with people, their experience in public and private sector jobs, for example. So as a result of the council's focus on merit, the applicants most qualified to be a judge, are forwarded to the governor for selection. And we all benefit from having a bench with judges that have the highest qualifications. We have not, in the state of Alaska, experienced problems with judges that are involved in, for example, scandals or case decisions that are marked by corruption and things like that. Really, we haven't had a problem with our bench. The council's current makeup works, and it works for the court system. But this resolution would unsettle the carefully considered balance between the non-attorney members, who bring the general public's perspective on what to look for in a judicial candidate, and the attorney members, who bring the lawyer's perspective on what to look for in a judicial candidate. It's the even balance, the equilibrium, that makes the council's system work so well. I am aware that the CS does change the numbers from three to six public members and maintains the three attorney members. For the court system, this still is not a balance. We would like to see the same number of attorney members as public members. The attorneys have a role in the discussion because they have direct experience with the applicant as another lawyer. They know about that applicant's legal knowledge, how their writing skills are, how they comport themselves in litigation, how their integrity is during rough times in litigation. Do they have the respect of their peers? These are the things that attorneys who have worked with the attorney applicant have direct information about when they're having a discussion about an applicant. And the public members bring an equally valid perspective. They know whether this person can connect with people, what their character is, how they can relate to non-attorneys, and whether they can keep the public's respect. Both of these are important roles in the job of screening judicial applicants. The current even balance that is set in the Constitution, that the three attorneys and three non-attorney members, means that the discussion and the decisions are focused on the merits of the and qualifications of the judicial applicants. Neither group can ignore the other's views. There needs to be four people, a consensus, in order to have action. So there has to be buy-in from somebody in the other group. So that's key. They have to, and they nearly always do, work together through consensus. I prepared a summary fact sheet for your consideration. I think it's in your packet. And I wanted to just highlight a few of the facts about the votes over the last years. It's about a two-page printout of numbers.
I'm sorry, I don't have that here.
That's what I'm seeing.
Jordan is going to deliver.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jordan.
I appreciate that, Jordan. This might look a little bit dense, but I just want to highlight a few things. The first page is just data about all the Judicial Council's votes on applicants over the last 29 years, which is as far back as their database goes. So over the last 29 years, you can see the total votes taken on that front page is 1,136 votes. If you skip down to the number of those votes that were unanimous, or unanimous except for one, which is usually 5-1, but sometimes somebody abstains, was 81% of those. So this is a group that is not dysfunctional. They work well together over the long haul. They've been working well together. You also heard testimony last week about the number of times that the Chief Justice votes. That only happens when his or her vote is needed to decide whether a name gets forwarded to the governor. Usually it's because there's a 3-3 tie, if there aren't four votes because somebody abstained. So you can also see on that sheet that since 1984, 94% of all applicants were agreed upon without a vote by the Chief. So the Chief Justice did need to vote 6% of the time, and that is 68 out of the 1,136 votes. And that's the number that you can see on your sheet, the fourth statistic down. So, but that is not the number of times that attorneys and non-attorneys were split. I think the focus last week during some testimony was that you often or do see votes where the attorneys take one position and the non-attorneys take another and the chief has to weigh in. So on that sheet, if you continue reading, the number of times that happened, number of times in which the vote was tied with attorneys and non-attorneys split was 15. We have 15 times over 29 years, 1.3% of the time that that's happened. Those numbers are so small that it's hard to draw definitive conclusions about what they might mean, but it's also hard to say that this indicates a problem or a trend or the thought that this happens on a consistent basis. So 15 times that they were split. Now, it is true that of the 15 votes that were tied at three attorneys and three non-attorneys, that the chief voted with the attorneys more often than the non-attorneys. That happened 10 out of those 15 times. So that is the case, and that's what our data does show. That is the Judicial Council's data does show. And you can see, jumping kind of down to the end of the page, that you can see that still the number of cases in which the vote was tied, attorneys and non-attorneys split, and the chief's vote was with the attorneys, and the name did not go to the governor, is still only 8 times over the last 29 years. 0.7% of the applicants had that experience. And again, those numbers are so small that there are very likely individualized reasons for those. But most of the focus last week was on testimony about what's happened more recently. And let me address that. If you flip to page 2, the top half of the page shows just the statistics, a subset, for the last 4 years. And you can see the total votes over the last 4 years were 201 votes, and still the committee is 75% of the time unanimous or almost unanimous. So again, indication that they're functioning fairly well. That's a pretty great number for consensus. And then you can see the Chief Justice voted 9 times, but only 7 of those were because the attorneys and non-attorneys split. So again, this is a subset of the first page. So you can see that it has happened more often in recent years, as the sponsor testified during the last hearing on this case. And you can see it is true, as the sponsor stated, that the number of votes were tied, with the attorneys and non-attorneys split, and the Chief Justice voted with the attorneys not to send the name to the governor. That did happen 5 times over the last 4 years. So out of the 15 of the that happened in the last 30 years, 5 of them just happened in the last 4. So I believe that's where the sponsor is seeing what I think he termed to be a trend or an issue that ought to be looked at. And I would just suggest to you that 5 votes over the last 4 years where that happened is very possibly, or maybe even probably, due to individuals, 5 individuals that, for whatever good and valid reason, were considered not to be qualified for the position for which they applied. Several of those were applications for the Supreme Court, which has quite demanding qualifications. And 2 of those were actually the same individual who 2 different chief justices voted not to put the name up for the governor. So with such a small number, it's hard to see that this is something that needs to be addressed with something so dramatic as a constitutional amendment. So I just want to point, the next half of the handout goes back another 4 years with similar data. So what I'm trying to show is that there is a lot of data. The data does show a slight bump in the last several years, but the numbers are so small, the actual numbers are so small, that it's, again, hard to say that this is a conclusion that we have a problem that needs to be addressed, that this that we just don't have the evidence in the data to show that something needs to be done. And that's what I just wanted to put these facts in front of you. You know, we can't be said that the 2 groups, the attorneys and non-attorneys, are factions or cliques or are even natural divisions in most of their votes. Again, 15 times over the last 29 years that they were split. So the statistics don't support that conclusion. I just also wanted to add that there was some mention last week about a problem that people don't know what happens very often with judgeships and judicial selections and with the Judicial Council. And I think it was Senator McGuire who said something about when people don't know, when a process is mysterious, they tend to assume the worst. And that is true, and that is something that the courts, as well as the council, have become more aware of over the years and are trying to address with things like public education and public outreach. Traditionally, judges have been constrained in what they can say publicly about their work and about a lot of things they do by ethical constraints, because, again, we want the public to believe that judges are completely impartial. I mean, they can't express their views about very many things outside of the courtroom. So, but recognizing that we're an institution that isn't as understood as some of the other branches of government, we've made a concerted effort to do more outreach, to do things like Supreme Court Live in other locations. It just happened today at West High School in Anchorage. They were in Barrow. They're talking about going to Barrow again, and perhaps Bethel and the Valley, to help people understand a little bit more about what goes on. And it's our hope that with more education and understanding, we'll diminish the mystery surrounding not just the courts, but also the Judicial Council. And I'm sure they are very aware of the fact that with a little more understanding, people would know these facts, for example, that the data is not as damaging as might be implied. So I had a couple more comments, but basically I want to welcome any questions about either the data, about the judges, about the screening, and again just stress that it doesn't support that we need a change, and that would be a big step for a system that has really worked quite well, and the even balance is important to the court system so that we keep the merit selection of judges, and we don't let one group on the council who might be of like mind go ahead and screen somebody and put their name up, even if the other group had serious misgivings. So the even numbers is what's key for the court system.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you. Senator Dyson has a question for you.
Yeah, I appreciate the testimony. In some senses, to me, it's wide of the mark. And just because there haven't been more split decisions and so on and so forth, I'm not sure it gets at the heart of the problem. I just note that I think almost no one has been nominated or appointed who hasn't had courtroom experience. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, it depends on the court level. I'd say it was fair to say, if this is your question, that people who are appointed as a judge have at least appeared in court before. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
As a lawyer.
I just note that I don't think hardly any of our last three attorney generals have had much courtroom experience, and probably would be unlikely to get nominated for a judge's position. And maybe that's the way it should be. But indeed, the lawyers on the Judicial Council would have little experience, if any, with an attorney general who didn't have any courtroom experience or any in the last decade or two. It's very difficult for me, and I suspect you even might have some difficulty, of really knowing, you know, the conscious or unconscious bias that someone might have. You know, and you can look at the merits and the very good criteria for it, but indeed, people on my end of the political spectrum worry about whether a judge is a strict constructionist, you know, or one of those who thinks, you know, it's great principles, but it needs to really be updated with wise folks in light of a changing world and all that sort of thing, rather than go back through the rigorous process to amend the Constitution, which is really tough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so we worry about that. And indeed, if you had all attorneys on there who really did believe, you know, that the Constitution needed judicial help to get updated, then they would consciously or unconsciously, select people. And then the other thing I worry about, and boy, I really see this with school boards and so on and so forth, is that the lay people, we citizens, are so overwhelmed by the expertise and the background that the experts from the, you know, school administration have, you know, that it's just tough. They don't compete on a level field, and they don't have the experience, nor does the layperson there have the resources to do the kind of research, you know, that the attorneys have and so on and so forth. So I don't buy the presupposition that three and three puts them all on the same level, you know, and I respect your judgment and the case you put forward, but there is that other consideration that I think is actually valid to think about.
Through the chair, if I may respond.
Sure.
Senator Dyson. First of all, the public members of the committee, I think you're maybe saying, sometimes in discussions might not have the skills or resources to express their views as vocally maybe as the attorney members, and may have their voice not as heard or their opinions quite as respected in the six-person discussion as you might like. And I'll let the executive director of the Judicial Council address that directly, but from what I've heard, the public members who have been appointed to that council have, to a person, been outspoken and have not felt pushed back in terms of expressing their opinions. I believe that the balance, the three and three, works because there has to be four people, and people do feel open, okay? But that's my understanding, and again, the Judicial Council can address it more directly. And with respect to the balance, I do want to stress that the three and three, or four and four, as long as it's it's a number where there has to be some buy-in from someone on the other side that allows a more even discussion, and so that one group's views aren't closed off.
Yeah. And respect,
Senator Dyson.
I'd hate to argue with you. You intimidate me.
Oh,
and your skill and your knowledge, plus your, you know, and so on. But be tough for me to argue with you on a legal basis. But indeed, these attorneys, you know, who are in practice and often in court, they know the other attorneys that are liable to get motivated. The public members on there, I don't think they have, the counsel has a research arm. You know, when somebody's liable to get nominated, who's going to do the research for them to go and find out, you know, all the stuff about the background of it? You know, they're ill-equipped, you know, to do that sort of thing. And I'm not debating with you, but those are legitimate concerns. And just your argument about how few times there has been a disagreement and so on and so forth is important, but not overwhelming.
Okay, and through the chair, just a quick factual response to that. All the members of the commission, the six, the three attorneys, the three public members, and the chief, receive voluminous materials on every applicant and do an in-person interview with each applicant. And I've heard that before it was electronic, they could get a stack a foot high of background information so that I don't think they view themselves as handicapped in terms of information about the individuals who are applying.
And that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. And many of the things you started off your statement with, I agree. For example, need a thorough and fair evaluation of judges. I just hope you don't think that the public members would be less thorough or fair than your barred members. And so in that particular case, I agree with you, unless you take exception to the public members, in which I would disagree with you strongly.
Mr. Chairman, true, we want a thorough and fair analysis of every applicant. What concerns the court is an imbalance, so that if, for example, there were one group had the majority and didn't necessarily need to listen to the concerns and the thoughts that the other group had, it would be have the potential to be unfair. So the group could be of one mind and want a certain thing in a judicial candidate and maybe not be as concerned about the legal skills or something, and that group wouldn't need to listen and wouldn't need any of the other group to be part of their consensus.
I think, just on a counterpoint to that, and I'm just bringing it up so that it stays out on the open and for discussion, there is a concern that those officers of the court, from the Supreme Court through the barred members, would have a kind of an almost an ethical obligation, and I find that that would be kind of a conflict problem in this particular area. So having public members have a little more say in it, I think, in that particular case, might actually bring a more vibrant discussion to it. So that's how some of us would see it. And so that's why I think we're having as serious a debate on this as we can.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can explain to me, as servants of the court or clerks of the court, where does that ethical obligation take them to in this particular case?
If I understand your question, Mr. Chairman, attorneys are considered officers of the court, meaning that they do have an obligation really in all of their dealings having to do with law, and really extends to everything else, to maintain a sense of integrity and honesty and fairness. And so with respect to this process, I think all it means is that the attorneys are obligated to be honest in their vote and to make their best shot. For example, if they have they just don't like a little something about somebody, not to vote against them because, oh, one time he beat me in a prior case, for example. That would be considered not the highest ethical standard, but to really judge the candidate or vote or discuss the candidate on the basis of their true qualifications.
Yeah. And so just from an outsider, it looks to me like a collegial peer pressure. And so and I've heard it used that way sometimes on the Judiciary Committee when challenging court decisions. And so just for my perspective, sitting on the Judiciary Committee now for 15 of my 16 years, that I've heard it at least four times that as officers of the court, they would struggle doing that. And to me, that sounded like they were using that for a pressure of consensus outside of the ethical bounds. So anyway, that I've heard it, and I just I wanted to bring it up that that some of us, even though I don't know the proper terms, have seen it used as a different discussion than what you just described.
I think I would just say to that, if I understand correctly, the three attorney members are not judges. They can't work for the state. And they are everyone that they are screening is an attorney. And certainly they reject or decide not to consider most qualified many, many of those applicants. In fact, the majority are considered not the most qualified to go. So in terms of sort of professional courtesy, if that's what I hear you saying, it isn't the case that the lawyers vote to always put up the names of other lawyers, because everyone who applies is a lawyer. They simply talk about the individual lawyer applicants, you know, with the private members, so that ethics or the professional courtesy doesn't seem to enter it when you look at
one,
it that
one way. One other question, and I do have some people who called in to testify, and I'd really would like to get to them, but one other question that comes to my mind, and we may continue this conversation. Let's see if I can state this. What is the peer pressure, ethical, I'm not too sure how to state it. What is the pressure of one of these members, the barred members, talking to judge selectees who may have to then practice in front of them? Tell me how that is generally protected under either ethics or conflict of interest issues. How do you deal with that in this particular case?
Well, I guess I'm thinking it through. Only the people that are voted yes go to the governor, and then those are the only people that have the potential to become judges.
Okay, so that might be properly a question for the Judicial Council, so okay. Maybe I will reserve that question for them, and if they'll think about it. If you don't mind, what I'd like to do is I had some people call in, and one of the reasons I'm actually a legislator is because I sat in a public testimony and got so angry because they let all the professionals have all the time, and I never did get to give my testimony.
No, John, it's because they knew you.
Maybe that's what it was.
I wonder if I could just add one fact on the sort of professional courtesy thing. The Chief Justice, as I say, has voted 15 times because of circumstances when there was a tie vote. But I want to be clear that often, and in the recent years, the majority of the votes were to say no on other sitting judges. So it's not the case where the justice feels a pressure, if this is maybe what you're getting at, to put the names of another judge forward to the governor. That, in fact, is the opposite. It just happened the other way.
And since I'm particularly sensitive, and thank you for that explanation, as a particularly sensitive legislator who lived through some scandal in the legislature, I don't know how you meant some of the conversation, but I have seen some judges withdraw because of potential scandal. And so scandal is something that we all going to have to deal with in all realms. And I hope you weren't just saying that the public members would be particularly susceptible to it, whereas the barred members would not.
Oh, no, I wasn't implying that there were any issues with scandal other than our sitting judges, I was trying to say, are by and large scandal-free. That is, our system has been working fairly well.
I just wanted to ask the question.
No.
Thank you very much. And what I'd like to do at this point is go ahead and go to the teleconference, if you don't mind, and there will be ample time for everybody. I commit to that. But I do want to make sure those who have taken the time to call get respect. And so Bill Gordon is on in Fairbanks. And if you don't mind, Bill, are you able to get to the phone right now and give us your testimony?
Yes, I'm here, Chairman Coghill. Thank you very much to you and to members of the committee. you're really to be commended for allowing so much testimony on this important constitutional topic. I'll try to be brief, and I'll try to only add to the discussion and not repeat what you've already heard from others today and your previous testimony. I think it was last Monday. I can agree that Alaska enjoys the strongest and most respected judiciary in the nation, and our process is the envy of all states. And as background, I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've lived in such diverse places as Point Hope, Nenana, Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, and my current home is Salche outside of Fairbanks. And I've served three different governors in various positions regarding judicial selection, including a six-year term as a non-attorney member of the Judicial Council. I had, way back when in my history, I had prior service on the governor's staff, and as part of my duties, I was asked to vet Judicial Council nominees for the governor's consideration for appointment. And that was early in my career, and so I worked for the Judicial Council in its early days after statehood in this process. And additionally, right now I serve as the current governor's appointee as a non-attorney member of the Alaska Bar Association, which is the body that selects the attorney members to the Judicial Council. So this gives me a perspective from just about every angle on the selection of judges in our state. And I can clearly tell you that when people say that we are the envy of the states, it's true, and I would urge the committee and the legislature as a whole not to take lightly making changes to this body. And let me explain a little bit here why I've come to this conclusion. It's hard to argue. I have a hard time arguing that more voices to the process isn't necessarily a good thing. You know, diversity of opinion in just about every matter should always be encouraged, and I submit the process the council uses already encourages input, almost exhaustive, and already allows the public many, many opportunities to affect the nomination of judicial applicants, whether they're in the room or not. And by traveling to their communities, holding public hearings, seeking out input, written and otherwise, there's a detailed process to gather public comment. And I can personally attest that each council member is provided multiple binders of this input as homework every night before they have their meetings. The Judicial Council is really the de facto human resources department for the judiciary. As most resource departments, they follow a very strict public process in reviewing of applicants. The council, but does consist of volunteer members, and they're willing to donate incredible amounts of time to accomplish this task. Each session, I think I recall, the council would sit. We'd sit for nearly a week at a time, in excruciating conditions sometimes, where we're sitting 8 to 5, reviewing applications, holding interviews, going around the room, and trying to get input from each of the members as complete as possible, allowing everybody the most latitude to come to what we consider is the best decision for passing on applicants to these important positions. Some have characterized the deliberations, I think I heard today, during the nomination as sort of a dance between weighing the interests of the non-attorney members against those of the bar. And having served for 6 years, I could say nothing could be further from the truth. I have found attorney members, and all six of them that I served with, to be Alaskans first. They are also members of the public. They happen to have valuable legal experience, but they're willing, like the non-attorney members, to volunteer considerable time away from their homes, their their livelihoods, their businesses, to assist in this process. Any aspersion that they are there truly just to try to promote their professional gain is just nonsense. The ones appointed to the council by the Alaska Bar Association, where I sit now, are the best legal minds in their professions. They also go through a process to get to that point. And it's a process that we're now even reviewing to make it even more transparent. And they live among us. They have families. They're active in their communities. They care about Alaska, its environment, its future, its schools. They particularly care about justice in our state, and not to have them equally represented just seems to me to be short-sighted. Council records will show the vast majority of votes taken on the council, as was presented earlier, show that the attorney members and the non-attorneys vote similarly. And this is certainly true on the ones who are passed on to the governor. It is nearly a unanimous selection for the top notch and the most qualified of any panel we see. And on rare occasion, when there's a division, it's rare, but it's probably on a vote regarding candidates on the edge of nomination, the ones that just don't quite reach to the qualification of the best of the bunch, which is what we want in Alaska serving on our judiciary. SDR 21, or the committee substitute, would add three more members to the council, and they're all appointed by the governor. That would be an increase of membership on the council of 50%. An increase in the size of membership by 50%, whether attorney or layperson, it doesn't matter, would only make a very difficult process much more cumbersome, to the members, but also to the applicants. The applicants who go through a horrendous process, basically putting their lives on hold for almost a year, they need to submit themselves to even more examination in a room. It just doesn't seem like it really adds anything to discussion. I think it might even likely lead to a drop in the quality and the quantity of applicants who take nearly a year to do this. Council members spend nearly 5 weeks a year in this process, to travel, and even more to travel and homework to accomplish their duties. Adding 50% more to this task would add weeks more. Just imagine, this has been proposed, and I've always sort of been opposed to it, but to be consistent here, imagine what adding 30 more members, 50%, the same 50% to the legislature. What might that do to the process of making law or constructing budgets? Would Alaskans benefit by this? More voices into the debate? Perhaps, and it's hard to argue against it. But what would the cost be? And I just think if you analyze this on a piece of paper, we'd say that maybe 60 is the right number. I'll speculate just a moment. I'm getting near to the end of what I want to say. But
thank you.
And the purpose.
Appreciate it, Bill. Yeah, if you could bring it to a wrap-up. I'm going to ask some of the others, though, while I paused you, if any of them cannot be here on Monday to testify, as soon as Bill is done, speak up, and then we'll go from there. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm speculating here, and sometimes, I'm trying to cut to the chase. That is my process. And if the purpose of the committee substitute now is really to give non-attorney members leverage equal to twice the voice of their attorney counterparts, which I think is unwise, I suspect it might be more efficient to consider another substitute, which would keep the council at six members and change the makeup to two attorneys and four laypersons. At least the process wouldn't be impacted and the cost wouldn't go up. Some have maintained the attorney members control the council and impose their will. Any description of that process is just as being contentious and pitting attorneys against others is not supported by the facts, as I'm sure the opinions of other past members would bear. The council is not, the mission is not to pass on to the governor's consideration just all qualified by applicants, but to determine, following a very clear protocol, who among them are the most qualified to serve the public and administer justice. Under the current process, that's exactly what Alaskans are getting. And finally, and in summary, I'll just add this, that through my 40 years of experience with the judicial selection process, I am confident the system is working properly and not in need of changes. I listened closely to the sponsor as he spoke about the purpose of his SJR 21 at the time. As far as I could tell, he really only talked of adding more voices in the interest of diversity. And any change should be supported by facts, offer a clear and defined purpose. In this tight budget environment, I think we must look for accountability and efficiency in the delivery of our government service. Any proposal advocating additional costs and inefficiency should clearly define a problem severely in need of fix. This doesn't do it. I don't think you should pass it out. And I appreciate your taking time to listen to me and to the others in opposition to this.
Thank you, Bill. And first of all, thank you for your lengthy service to Alaskan people, especially in this arena, and the unambiguous testimony. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Elaine Andrews is in Anchorage. Elaine, are you able to come back at another time, or do you want to go ahead and speak up now?
I can join you on Monday. If you're going to be reconvening on Monday,
we will be.
If there are people there, actually, I would almost prefer that the people who've flown to Juneau get heard, because I can be by the phone on Monday.
That's a good point. Thank you very much. David Landry, same question.
Chairman Coghill?
Yes.
Yes, I'm here.
Are you able to be with us on Monday when we reconvene?
You know, I am not, and what I have to say is very, very brief.
Well, why don't you go ahead? I'll have you give testimony then. I want as many people on record as I can. So, David, go ahead, put yourself on record and give testimony.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Coghill and other committee members. I'm against SJR 21, as evidenced by the previous testimony of Ms. Mead and Mr. Gordon, very knowledgeable about the facts of the situation. It appears to be a solution in search of a problem. And I don't really think there's a problem that needs to be solved. I was alerted to this by reading the AP story in the Daily News, and Ms. Mead fleshed out what that article said, and you know, there's just really not a problem. The judicial system works very well, kind of the things that are highlighted by Senator Kelly really are not to the level of needing to do this constitutional change. You know, there's been not a lot of conflict between the, the citizen membership and the attorney membership. And in the situations, according to the AP story, in those situations, the Chief Justice has sided with the attorneys in a little over half the instances, which says to me that it's working very fairly and almost arbitrarily as far as where things land. So I would not pass this on, and I would just, continue on with the great system we have now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I greatly appreciate that. That will take us to James Cannon. James, are you able to hear us, and are you able to be with us another time, or do you want to testify today?
I'm not. Yes, this is James Cannon, Fairbanks. I probably could be back on. Well, let's see. I'm sorry. I do have a hearing Monday all morning.
Well, we got 8 minutes. Go ahead and give us some testimony, James.
Well, I'll be real brief about it. I'm an attorney here in Fairbanks. I've been licensed to practice in Alaska for 38 years. It was my great pleasure between 2006 and 2012 to serve a six-year term on the Judicial Council. And I value greatly the friendships that I've made with people like Bill Gordon, and many others that served as public members. I think the system works great. There's something of a bit of genius from the people that wrote this article of our Constitution when they selected the size. It's as if you could all sit around a kitchen table. And in many ways, when we deliberate, when we do interviews, which involves a lot of preparation, by the way, usually 80 to 100 pages of material, which takes, we probably read it twice before we go in to the actual interviews. Everybody is open. Everybody's respectful with each other. The public members often ask incredibly incisive questions that builds that's a benefit to everyone. But I would urge you to go back and read the minutes in the constitutional debate where they talk about why they selected it this way. The whole purpose was to help to get to the governor the best timber. And although we describe it as a merit system, the founders of the Constitution also understood that the governor was the one or one of two people elected by the whole people of the state of Alaska, and that he, if politics were important to how he appointed, he had a limited means of imposing that by the people that he nominated or she nominated to the Alaska Judicial Council. This amendment would throw that out of whack. I would also say that I served on the council with three chief justices. I've heard two of them express opinions about why philosophically they would vote. Almost, in my experience, they usually voted with the public members. It was rare. I can only think of one instance on my service. Maybe there were two when the chief justice did not, when there was a 3-3 split, attorney members versus non-attorney members, and the chief justice voted with the attorney members. What I've heard, and I can recall one particular phraseology from the chief justice was that he would only vote against an applicant if he thought appointment of that applicant to that judicial position would do harm to the institution of the judiciary. Sad to say, sometimes it gets to that point. People on the Judicial Council usually are unanimous or close to unanimous, and we try to avoid putting the Chief Justice in that position. It rarely happens that they are, but when they do vote against passing somebody up, I think it is often, as that Chief Justice said, to avoid doing harm to the institution of the judiciary. I would urge you not to pass this along. It's not an amendment we need. I think in some ways it is. As the representative of the court system said, or maybe I'm misquoting, but a solution looking for a problem. There's really not much of a problem there, if there's any problem at all. So thank you very much for your time and listening to me.
James, thank you very much. Really appreciate you taking the time. And Elaine, I will ask, if you wouldn't mind, I'll make sure that you get top of the list on Monday. Thank you for following with this argument. And the same with Deborah, with the Alaska Bar Association. Monday we'll continue the discussion. So thank you very much for taking the time. And that's also true with the Judicial Council. I want to give you plenty of time to go ahead and have the conversation. Certainly, yeah, I'm going to give the sponsor.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Senator Coghill, this is Deborah O'Regan.
Yes.
I'm not available on Monday because I've got the bar exam going on next week. I apologize for that.
Oh, my. Do you want to send in a written testimony and I can have it put on the record?
I did. Senator Coghill sent a written testimony in to Jordan yesterday afternoon.
Okay. Thank you. And I have not read it yet. I will make sure that it gets on all members' desks, though.
Okay. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them now, but I did send in written testimony about the process to Jordan.
My apologies for running the clock so tight. I actually expected that I have more time to do this than we did. And so if need be, I will try to get your testimony in front of everybody and discuss it, and maybe with all due respect, if I can have you call in another time, I may very well do that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. And anytime we have a constitutional amendment, I think requires that we think through, you know, why are we doing it? And I want to make sure that the Judicial Council Executive Director gets plenty of time to speak. And then I want the sponsor of the bill to be able to consider those things and speak to us authoritatively. I understand why those who have been involved in it see it as such a good and stellar institution. I don't know that I disagree with that, but I also know that there are many people, including in my district, who feel like it's not only mysterious, but tilted towards a legal system that sometimes does not see it serving its own people. And so I will try to articulate that in my closing remarks, but that's something that Judicial Council will just ponder a little bit as you give your testimony. With that, we have run right up to the closing hour. Thank you very much for the thoughtful conversation, the thorough conversation. And we'll continue this on Monday, but also we have two other bills that we will consider on that day. Senate Bill 108 by Senator Dyson on public access to criminal records, which I'll have him introduce, and that's all we are is introducing, because my intention is to debate Senate Joint Resolution 21. Also, I will have a bill on multidisciplinary child protection teams that I will just bring up by way of introduction so that you will get the kind of the concept. With that, thank you very much. We will adjourn this Judiciary Committee.